Hello, I'm Paul Pape. This is number 0882, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0882. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, once again, we'll talk to legendary science fiction author Robert J. Sawyer, who has written his first non-fiction novel. It's called Sawyer on Science Fiction.
I've been fighting since the beginning for science fiction to be recognized as a form of literature every bit as complex, every bit as nuanced, every bit as heart-wrenching as any other kind of literature. And I've been saying that since day one and calling out my colleagues when they go too deep into just talking about technology. Science fiction is not Tom Clancy in the future. It's not endless descriptions of how this and that works. It is an exploration of how the human mind and heart will deal with the huge changes that we're going to face as a species.
Greg Watts is a songwriter, author, and mentor who has had 18 Eurovision entries across 11 consecutive years. What's the secret to the success of a hit song?
There's many times where you think there's going to be big success, you get a big artist, and then your songs are released with this big artist that we've been dreaming of for years, and then some reason it doesn't work. And it can be all sorts of reasons, right? The record label doesn't input, and you can find out later many of them, but you don't know at the time. It could be that the songs weren't any good, but it's usually there's something wrong with the promotion. And even Eurovision itself, you have a great song get there, and then something doesn't quite happen there. It's basically a big event where it's not just about the song. You need the singer, you need the stage show, you need everything to come together, and sometimes there's luck in that as well where things don't always come together.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, the tribe has spoken as we look at 50 seasons of Survivor with Jeff Probst. So light up your torches, the tribal council begins soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0882, was Paul Pape, who is a creative entrepreneur, TED talker, and author. He also runs Paul Pape Designs and was on the show back on number 0878, which you can go and listen to that one again. Thank you very much, Paul, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. A semi-truck leaked 40,000 pounds of Frank's Red Hot Sauce along Interstate 71 in Delaware County, Ohio, last week during a heat wave exceeding 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The sauce began leaking June 30th as the truck traveled north, leaving a trail firefighters followed to a nearby truck stop. Fire Chief Chris Kovach says crews contacted the Ohio EPA using containment pools and hazmat materials to prevent environmental damage. While the incident drew humor online, Kovach warned of real consequences. He said, "There are some cars, a lot of vehicles, that may have potentially been damaged. One driver reportedly spent $30 on car washes without removing the staining. The trucking company is arranging cleanup, and Ohio State Highway Patrol may issue citations. Affected drivers can seek insurance compensation."
Frank's Red Hot. I put that on everything. It's the perfect blend of flavor and heat. I put that on everything.
Yeah, but not on cars. Last weekend was obviously the biggest bash of all time in the U.S. Of course, I'm talking about Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce's Madison Square Garden wedding. If you're someone who just can't get enough of the event, there are some opportunistic sellers that are cashing in. A website called New York City Garbage is selling actual refuse collected outside Madison Square Garden on the couple's July 3rd wedding date. Items include soda can tops, fabric scraps, and a single AirPod, each priced at $25. For bigger spenders, an eBay seller is offering a bag of air allegedly collected outside MSG for $49,999.99. That listing has already surpassed 200 views at press time. The wedding itself featured notable highlights, including Adam Sandler officiating, MSG transformed into a garden setting, and a live performance of I Wanna Hold Your Hand by Paul McCartney. Wow, McCartney's available for weddings now. Looks like he's going to have a busy summer. A 36-year-old Fort Wayne, Indiana man faces a felony arson charge following a bizarre and disturbing incident. Christopher Peden allegedly used a kitchen knife to sever his own genitals in a garage at around 2 a.m., then poured gasoline on the dismembered organ and set it ablaze. The Fort Wayne Fire Department responded to the garage fire in May, while police were simultaneously dispatched to reports of a stabbing nearby. Peden initially told officers he had been stabbed downtown. He later admitted at the hospital that he had been dishonest and confessed to the self-inflicted act. Investigators found gasoline, four lighters, and a kitchen knife at the scene. Arson carries up to 12 years in prison. Okay, what I want to know is, was this a spur-of-the-moment thing, or was it well thought out? Either way, I'm baffled. And I also want to know, did he detach both Jim and the twins? And also, how does he now pee? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a British Airways flight carrying up to 336 passengers was canceled after multiple cabin crew members were allegedly too intoxicated to work following a night of heavy drinking in Barbados. The incident involved staff at a high-end resort the night before Sunday's BA-254 flight from Bridgetown to London. One attendant reportedly vomited at the bar, while another collapsed and had to be carried to his room. Eurocontrol data indicates the cancellation cost BA over $133,000 in hotels and transport for stranded passengers. Four employees have since been suspended. British Airways says it is urgently investigating and expects the highest standards from staff. Well, as someone of Barbadian descent, I can attest that some foreigners can't handle the Bajan rum.
Take your holiday seriously. British Airways holidays. Adult protected.
Well, that British Airways commercial tag doesn't exactly hold up. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Robert J. Sawyer is back on the program, and he's here with something a little different. The premier Canadian science fiction writer has come out with his first nonfiction book. It's called Sawyer on Science Fiction. Robert joins us from Toronto via Riverside.com. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. I have read several of your items on social media, and you're not one to either overpraise or pull your punches. Is this the idea where you got this book from?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think a lot of people who are writers are afraid to take a stand on anything. What constitutes a good book? What constitutes a bad book? What constitutes a good reader and what constitutes a bad reader. And I wanted to, you know, stake my claim and say, this is what I believe. These are the hills that I'm willing to die on.
You're also, though, someone who is in the public eye, and you need and you want to attract certain fans. Are you concerned about the idea of ruffling a few feathers?
You said the key word there was the adjective, certain fans. I long ago gave up any idea that everybody in the world would love to read Robert J. Sawyer books. No author's books are appealing to every single person. Even my genre, which is science fiction, isn't appealing in terms of print, books and short stories to everybody, although almost everybody consumes it these days in film and television. So what I'm looking for not is the largest possible audience, but the most appreciative group of readers that I can find for the work that I do. So yeah, if I lose some people along the way here because I've taken some sharply worded opinions in Sawyer on science fiction, that's okay. There are other books they can read, other authors that they can follow, but the people for whom what I say resonates will feel even more connected to me as a writer, my work, and to the field that presumably they, as readers of science fiction, and I dearly love, science fiction.
What was the gestation period before you decided to actually write this book? Or did you, at the time, just decide to write this book and wrote it?
So this is mostly a compilation of material that I've written over the last 35 years about science fiction, going back to, you know, article in the 1980s for the Toronto Star, right up to stuff that I wrote just a couple of months ago. I've been commissioned over the years many times by Slate, by the journal Science, by the CBC, any number of places, to write something about science fiction or to review somebody else's science fiction work, including Margaret Atwood's, as I did in Maclean's and the Ottawa Citizen. And it was always in the back of my mind, you know, maybe there's a market for all of this stuff when it gets compiled into a single volume. And I set about doing that last year, and it was 300,000 words, about the thickness of three average novels in the first draft. And so I went through and kind of brutally cut things that were peripheral to science fiction or just hadn't aged well because they were talking about, you know, how to do online research as a science fiction writer in the pre-World Wide Web era. There's just no point in reprinting that at this point. And got it down to 225,000 words. Still a massive book. You could kill a man with it. But it is a career retrospective and a really in-depth look at the history of science fiction over the last third of a century. Both my work and the work of my colleagues, and of course, looking back on the giants whose shoulders I stand on, Clark Asimov, Poole, Judy Merrill, Mary Shelley, endless numbers of great predecessors of mine.
Well, you said that you cut some things out because they just didn't live well in today's technology and in what is going on in today's age. But have you decided, in looking back at some of the stuff that you wrote, have your opinions changed in any way, shape, or form over some of the stuff you had written earlier?
The biggest change, of course, has been in my view of AI. I think as a science fiction writer, you know, if you go back and look at my oeuvre, my collection of books over the years, I'd written science fiction novels where AI was our greatest friend. And I'd written some where AI was an existential threat. And, obviously the large language models, ChatGPT and so forth, were unleashed upon us without anybody asking for them and no plebiscite requesting them a few years ago. And that caused me to, you know, it's one of those moments where Walter Cronkite years ago would have said, science fiction has become science fact. We're facing, in our everyday lives now, AI. And I've decided, I was Pollyanna-ish, I was naive when I said there was a win-win scenario for us and AI. It's an existential threat. And that certainly is an opinion that's crystallized in the last few years and is not reflected in the older pieces on AI in my new book, Sawyer on Science Fiction.
On the other hand, are there some things that you wrote 20, 30 years ago that for you are just evergreens, that this hasn't changed in the last few decades?
Absolutely. I've been fighting since the beginning for science fiction to be recognized as a form of literature every bit as complex, every bit as nuanced, every bit as heart-wrenching as any other kind of literature. And I've been saying that since day one and calling out my colleagues when they go too deep into just talking about technology. Science fiction is not Tom Clancy in the future. It's not endless descriptions of how this and that works. It is an exploration of how the human mind and heart will deal with the huge changes that we're going to face as a species going down the pike. And I've been very adamant from the beginning that science fiction, not just my work, the work of the ambitious authors in my field, is literature, is powerful, is life-changing, and has something to say, despite what I said a few moments ago about me only seeking a very narrow audience of appreciative readers, something to say to everybody, Pete.
Well, why do you not think that science fiction is as respected as it should be?
Every once in a while, you still get, and far more frequently than you should, articles that will say nonfiction in a newspaper, a magazine, or on TV, but that's just science fiction, by which they mean, but that's just made up garbage, right? They just pulled that out of the air. No, my colleagues and I work enormously hard to keep as abreast as any good science nonfiction writer, science journalist would, with all of the cutting edge advancements in science and technology, and bring great rigor and logic to our extrapolations about where they may be in the future. So when people say that's just science fiction, and they still do say that, what they mean is that's just fantasy. And by fantasy, they mean something that could never actually happen. Whereas science fiction is an exploration of those things that probably could happen, plausibly might happen, and may indeed be our future 5 years, 50 years, 500 years, 5,000 years down the road.
In this day and age, it seems to be that everyone is in their own little camp of some kind or silo. It's very divisive in this day and age. Yet you have this book coming out. What is your hope for this particular book? Do you hope that it will spark a conversation amongst people, either within the sci-fi fan community or people who are outside of the sci-fi fan community?
I think it's going to do both those things, or I hope it will anyways. Within the science fiction community, there are going to be those who say, Sawyer is wrong. His take on H.G. Wells isn't right. His feminist take on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is out to lunch. There'll be people who will argue with me. And that's fine, because science fiction has always been the literature within itself of one work arguing against another. Famously, Robert A. Heinlein's novel, he was a World War II soldier glorifying war, called Starship Troopers, versus Joe Haldeman's novel, he was a Vietnam draftee who didn't want to be there and was severely injured in combat, novel Forever War, about how reprehensible war is. These are dialogues that science fiction always has. So absolutely, people will disagree with me. And as long as they disagree with me in a civil fashion, of course, I welcome it. Outside the science fiction readership, I just want people who hadn't thought about science fiction as being anything other than pew, pew, you know, ray guns and silly rubber face mask costumes, to realize just how much thought, depth, philosophy, research, and concern with human morality goes into good science fiction writing.
Would you agree that those who aren't necessarily science fiction fans, the pew-pew, as you just described, are not seeing the forest for the trees, in that I've always felt that science fiction is a morality tale about what's going on today set in the future? Am I wrong?
Yes. You're not wrong at all. In fact, if your science fiction film and television history was, of course, Twilight Zone and the original Star Trek, you know that very, very well. It's Star Wars and a lot of purely escapist entertainment that came after that that started confusing people. What is the moral of, you know, the first episode of Star Wars? What is the deep philosophical thought that went into the second one? People will pull little things out of the air, but they weren't social comment. They weren't about preparing us for a tomorrow. In fact, they disclaimed that by all starting with a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. They got nothing to do with the here and now or the likely yet to come. And I want to get us back to that Twilight Zone original Star Trek take on the genre. 1968's Planet of the Apes, another great example of science fiction as social comment, a formative film for me. I want to get us back to that, to the public perception being that it is thoughtful, intelligent extrapolation. And to take under the umbrella Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, which is absolutely a work of science fiction. George Orwell's 1984, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. These are core works of science fiction that people pluck out in order to make a specious argument. After you pluck out all the good stuff, what you're left with in any field is garbage, of course. And science fiction preferentially has to face that particular prejudice. And I'm standing up against it in this book, Sawyer on Science Fiction.
Well, I look forward to Sawyer on Science Fiction to open up the debate on both sides of both the science fiction world and also the science fiction and non-science fiction world. When will the book come out and how can one get it?
Sawyer on Science Fiction, traditionally published in print, by Shadow Paw Press, fine Canadian publisher, but available worldwide, comes out August 4th. It's also available on that day in an ebook edition as well, if you prefer, from any ebook vendor you name, Kindle, Kobo, Apple Books, you know, Google Books, whatever you like. So basically, it'll be out there everywhere. And if your local bookstore hasn't stocked it, well, A, shame on them, but B, just ask them to order it. Any bookstore anywhere can order a book. You just give them the author's name and the auth and the title, and they look it up. They two clicks of a computer button, and they'll have a copy for you in a couple of days. But you'll find it in the major chain bookstores for sure, and online retailers.
Robert, thank you once again for taking the time to be on the program with us.
What an absolute pleasure, Peter. Thank you. So we say in the science fiction game, live long and prosper.
Science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer. His latest novel is Sawyer on Sawyer. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show number, which is show number 0882, and you'll find links to Robert's site. And also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
I entered the World Kleptomaniac Championship Tournament. I took gold, silver, and bronze.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Does it feel to you like AI is taking over? That the bots are winning? That AI actually stands for alarmingly invasive? If you crave more human connection, reach out to friends, play with your children, call your mom, and do what you're doing right now. Listen to the radio. Radio is thankfully, imperfectly human. No ifs, ands, or buts.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to singer, songwriter, author, and producer Greg Watts. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We still have a Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner and a morning shower thought and, of course, an idiot of the day. But we've got much more in Stuff All News right here, right now. I'm sure you've heard the saying that youth is wasted on the young. A Waymo self-driving car in California called police on two 15-year-old passengers allegedly drinking and firing toy guns during their ride. San Mateo police responded after Waymo reported the teens were drinking and shooting from the vehicle. The driverless car then pulled into a parking lot and waited for officers to arrive. Video footage showed police approaching the robo-taxi with weapons drawn. The teens had been firing gel-filled Orbeez pellets from toy guns out of the moving vehicle. Police publicly scolded the teens on Facebook, noting that toy guns can cause injury and alarm, while acknowledging the situation would have been so much worse had they chosen to drive impaired instead. Well, they're 15. They don't have licenses yet. Anyway, whether charges will be filed remains unclear. But as I've said in the past, their parents must be so proud. While on patrol along the South Coast, Officer Lane Garrison of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife went by the Tokeland Tidelands in Pacific County and spotted a man allegedly trying to hide a crab, first in a woman's coat and then under her hat. As the officer observed them, a second couple with sagging clothing joined them. He approached the couples, who submitted five crabs for inspection, saying that this was all they had. He pointed to a crab leg sticking out from under the woman's hood. Then he noticed her pants were moving. Said Garrison, "Those are crabs in there?" This is probably the only time a police officer can say that to a woman and not face HR problems. Anyway, Garrison also looked into her jacket, where there were extra pockets sewn in, and all were packed with crabs. A second officer arrived, and he spotted something too. He said, "Does she have crab in her bra?" She did. And again, no need to call HR. Despite insisting six different times that there were no more crabs, the officers continued to find more, at least 21 in all. All four were cited for harvesting undersized crabs, punishable by a fine of up to $1,000 and up to 90 days in jail, and for failing to submit their catch for inspection, punishable by a fine of up to $5,000 and up to a year in jail. Well, when it comes to the shell game, the house always wins. Most American commodity manufacturing long ago moved to Asia, but not Global Protection Corporation. Classically founded in a Massachusetts college dorm room at Tufts University in 1987, the company has been growing since and is known for inventing the glow-in-the-dark condom. Another GPC innovation, condoms in 52 distinct sizes. Today, GPC makes 250 million condoms per year, necessitating a larger headquarters, and they've just moved into a new building in Lynn, Massachusetts. The historic building that's now GPC's headquarters, wait for it, was built as a creamery. So really, not much has changed.
The Stuff File program presents asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
A Missouri man was wearing a promotional shirt from his bail bondsman when he was rearrested for violating his release terms. 22-year-old Ethan Zane Adams was originally placed on 2 years probation following a 2024 conviction. He allegedly violated probation with new DWI and domestic assault arrests. A judge set bond at $3,000, which Colombia-based Jesus Bebe Bail Bonds posted. The company gifted Adams a promotional t-shirt upon release. Their policy states, whenever we bond you, you get one free. Adams skipped his June 24th hearing, prompting an arrest warrant. Deputies caught him a week later, and he posed for his July 2nd mugshot, still wearing the Jesus Bebe shirt. Adams now faces a $6,000 bond and no further help from Jesus Bebe Bail Bonds. Oh, so that means he doesn't get another free shirt. Not even a punch card.
This has been the Stuff File Program, Asinine Situations That Make You Want to Scream Into a Pillow.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
There once was a girl named Yvette who played on a gold cornet. She blew such a blast, the neighbors ran fast and haven't stopped running quite yet.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Greg Watts is a songwriter, publisher, author, and mentor who has been involved in 18 Eurovision entries across 11 consecutive years, working with artists and songwriters from many countries in the world. He has also built songwriting camps across Europe. Greg joins us from the UK via Riverside.com. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Greg. Great to see you. Great to hear you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I want to go back a little bit because, first of all, your book, we should mention it, is called Keeping the Dream Alive. And it sounds like you've had some difficulties in the past with, you know, dealing with your self-esteem. And that's what you want to help with a mentee. And I'm just curious to know, you've done 11 consecutive years in Eurovision. What was it like that first year? And were you apprehensive at all in that first year that you did it?
I was excited more than apprehensive because I'd never done it before. And I'd probably been trying for 10 years. So I was much more excited. I didn't know what to expect. And when I got there, it was one of these strange experiences. It was very big. It's like being at the Olympics. And to be honest, I just took it in my stride. We didn't do very well in that particular one. So that was the negative thing. But that for me, I always, if we don't do so well, I make sure I get back and go again, as you can see.
Well, that brings my next point in that you didn't do that well in the first year. So in the subsequent year, what lessons did you take from that first year that helped you propel going on?
Well, I've learned, over the years, that really losing is just learning how to win. And I don't see losing as I've lost. I sort of see it as, you know, out of 40 songs, we came 29th or something like that. So we always take that forward into the next year and always think, how do we learn? What do we learn from it? Each year is different. That particular year, we went from one artist up to two artists, so that was great. But we really learned that the first year, we didn't really have the artist available. She had some mental health problems. She didn't do any publicity. We just all pulled together as a team that first year. But the second year, we learned, having two really sort of active artists, that actually the first year, it does really affect it if the artist can't be as present, I guess.
Is there some sort of, for lack of a better term, dating ritual? How do you get together with the talent and you know that you want to work with them?
Yes, dating ritual. I think it's been songwriting camps is the best thing to do. So we hosted our own songwriting camps. We invited people from all around the world and we invited artists. Some came, some didn't. And each year, the more success we have, the bigger the artist that comes, in a sense. And now we have people approach us instead of us approaching them. But it was really, we had to sort of reach out and say, look, we're going to spend a lot of money on doing a songwriting camp, come and join us. So we had to take that risk. But people did come, and slowly that grew.
Well, let's talk about the songwriting camps, because, you know, there was a time back in music where there were songwriters and singers, and it just seems to be with time that more singers are also songwriters. When did that situation shift, and what is the difference between a singer-songwriter and just a singer?
Yeah, I think it's been shifting backwards and forwards for years, because if you think Elvis wasn't writing songs, but the Beatles were, and then the Beatles wrote songs for other people, but then it also goes through stages where people didn't write so much and artists did. But I guess the last 10 years, we were pitching songs to artists in Eurovision, and then what's happened is over the last five years, it's been the artists want to come and they want to write their own songs. I think it's more about, it's reflecting the rest of the music industry. And the artist wants to be authentic. They don't necessarily want to sing a song that they haven't written themselves, or at least haven't been involved with, saying this is what I want. So there's an element of authenticity is becoming really important in Eurovision as well as the other music industry.
When you write a great song, how do you know that it's going to the right singer?
Sometimes you don't. If you write a great song and pitch it, sometimes you're trying to get it to the right people, and sometimes it goes and you get it somewhere and the artist performs it, but they probably weren't quite the right artist for it. But when you do know, you do know. That you have this feeling of, I don't know, everything fits together. It's like a plan all coming together all at once. So in a way, those are the emotional connection, the goosebump moments where you realise, I think a lot of it is luck, but we struck lucky here and got the right song with the right singer on the right stage show.
As a songwriter, do you write to particular people, or do you write a song and then find the particular singer?
I think that has changed over the years. Now, I think more we're trying to bring the singers in and writing for and with the singers again, because then it's authentically them. We're not trying to get them to imagine them singing the song. They've actually been there at the start of the creation. Eurovision is a very visual show, so in a way you want to tell a story. If the artist is connected to the story, that really, really helps. It used to be we'd write a song and try and find the right artist, but now most of the time we're writing with the artist. So we're finding the artist first and then saying, what do you need? Let's write for you and with you.
As I mentioned, you have a book called Keeping the Dream Alive. What exactly is the book about? And whom did you write it for? Who were you trying to reach as far as the reader was concerned?
I guess there's two parts. Keeping the Dream Alive started as a bit of my life story during COVID, and I wanted to leave a legacy to my kids. So I started to tell stories about my journey through the music industry. Soon after COVID, I started a mentorship. And then once I started to finish the book, I sort of realized that the two fit together. The stories were part of teaching and coaching and mentoring other writers. And you mentioned self-esteem earlier. Nearly every writer I come across has ups and downs, you know, with anxiety. That's part of the creative circle. And actually, I think I've experienced so much in music that I think actually I can really coach others through the highs and the lows, because actually the lows are just as important as the highs, because you learn from them. So,
as someone who has gone through the journey of music writing, and sometimes you are so in tuned with what you are doing that you're not seeing the whole picture, but as you wrote a book which literally tells your life, did you kind of learn things about yourself that you didn't really think of during the course of your career?
Yeah, when you write a book, and actually when you mentor people, you find yourself telling them, you should do this, you should do that, and actually it's often speaking back to yourself. So actually, and as well, when I'm writing, I'm almost dumping the information out of my brain. And so many stories came where one would come out, and as that one came out, there was another behind it that I'd forgotten about. So I learned, actually through writing, I really learned a lot about my career, and it's almost changed my career in, I know what different directions to go in from the writing, in a sense, because it's pushed me in a different way.
Well, exactly how has it changed your career in writing this book?
I think it's moved me. I mean, I believe that in your career, you have transitional periods. I was a writer. then I became a publisher, then an A&R, and now I see myself much more as a book writer, author, plus a mentor. And I think the book writing and the mentoring, that goes together. It doesn't mean I don't write songs ever, but I see myself as the important part of what I do is developing others, rather than my own career as a songwriter. I think a lot of people that I can develop will go a long way further than I did, because my strength is in development.
Have your musical tastes changed since you first started songwriting?
Not one bit. So there was a period where I had a bit of a dark period and didn't know what, I didn't want to do it anymore, and I fed up, and I basically went back to the early 80s and my favourite music that I discovered when I was first getting into it, the Tears for Fears, your Duran Duran, your OMD, all sort of music like that. And I realised that I was really inspired again. So that's one thing I teach my writers is, when you're having your uncreativeness, go and listen to that music that you had in your magic period, the first time you discovered music. You soon get inspired again, and you soon remember, this is why I did it, this is why we do it. It's not to sort of make money or to be successful. We sort of lose ourselves into that. The actual reason we do this is because we love songs. So I have to remind, whenever I want to remember that, I go back and listen to music that's from the 80s and early 90s maybe. I don't listen to the music that we're creating at home because it's work.
Over the years, what has been the greatest success for you at Eurovision?
I think results-wise, back in 2021, we had a song called Je Me Casse, which was third in the jury voting, and then I think it finished seventh in overall, so that was a big success. But I think probably the biggest success that I felt wasn't actually Eurovision itself. It was in last year in Luxembourg, or actually this year in January, we had the 6 songs out of 8 in the national final. And at one point, 3 of my songs got forward to the super final, and I could sit there and say, I know I'm going to win this. And it was kind of that big feeling of, we've been involved in making the whole show, and it was just a very, very special moment. And that, not because it was successful, but I was there with 12 other songwriters and they've all been with me on a long journey to get there. So hence in the book, I'm not always talking about success. I'm talking about, actually, part of this is you need to enjoy the journey along the way, because we only live once, and I get to do some amazing things. Actually, it's not all about winning and losing or becoming successful. Sometimes it's just about enjoying the moment and being with the right people too.
Have you ever been surprised by either the success of a particular song that you have been part of, or conversely, have you been surprised by the lack of success of a particular song?
Yes, lots of times. There's many times where you think there's going to be big success, you get a big artist, and then your songs a release with this big artist that we've been dreaming of for years, and then some reason it doesn't work. And it can be all sorts of reasons, right? The record label doesn't input, and you can find out later many of them, but you don't know at the time why. It could be that the songs weren't any good, but it's usually there's something wrong with the promotion, or and even Eurovision itself, you have a great song get there, and then something doesn't quite happen there, because it's basically a big event where it's not just about the song, you need the singer, you need the stage show, you need everything to come together. And actually, sometimes there's luck in that as well, where things don't always come together. So sometimes it goes further than you think, sometimes it's less.
How soon after a Eurovision entry and a Eurovision year do you start working on the next year?
Eurovision is let's say May the 15th. We are running camps from June the 1st. So we pretty much a year cycle. Of course, we're submitting songs probably from September through to maybe January, but all the finals are around January, February, March. But yeah, we start straight away. And actually, we're still working this year, probably for a couple of years ahead, because we believe the artists we're developing now, some of them aren't ready yet, but in 2 or 3 years' time, they become ready. And again, because that's sometimes they're getting close but not quite winning, and they're getting into a final not winning, but next time they'll come back and have the experience to win.
Well, congratulations on your success this far, and also congratulations on the book, which is called Keeping the Dream Alive. Greg, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, and you're from Canada, is that right?
Yes.
Going out mainly in Canada? Because Canada's just about to join Eurovision, have you heard that?
Yes.
So we may be seeing a Canadian entry, hopefully with Dida, we'll be on it at some point soon as well. So, but thank you for having me.
Maybe that's something that somebody that you can mentor.
Yeah, would love to. Anyone from Canada wants to do Eurovision, get in touch.
Greg Watts. songwriter, publisher, author, and mentor. The full title of his book is called Keeping the Dream Alive, A Songwriter's Guide to Overcoming Rejection, Finding Success, and Enjoying the Journey Along the Way. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0882, and you'll find links to Greg's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about. This is Morning Shower Thoughts.
How come your lips don't touch when you say the word touch, but they do when you say the word separate?
Morning Shower Thoughts from the Stuff File Program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
The Stuff File program is everywhere on several stations and on several platforms, including YouTube.
The YouTube handle is youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
That's kind of long-winded, isn't it? Just go to YouTube and type out my name, Peter Anthony Holder.
On YouTube, you'll find interviews, short vertical videos, and more. There's lot to check out.
Again, that's youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
Oh, for the love of God, just go to YouTube and type in my name.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we will find out if Stuart Nallman's porch is snuffed out. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. No, I could see very well in the dark here. My torch is still lit, thank goodness.
Okay.
You know what? Why we're talking about torches and all that, we're not promoting pyromania. We're talking about Survivor, because it was 25 years ago, a group of total strangers were dropped off on an island in Borneo to undergo 3 weeks of basically unpredictable weather, physically demanding challenges, and ongoing interpersonal strategies and skullduggery so that one participant would be left standing for $1 million prize. And thus, Survivor was born. 25 years and 50 seasons and 751 players later, Survivor has become the dean of the competitive reality television genre that still attracts viewers and has turned its contestants into pop culture celebrities and spawned just as equally popular shows of that nature like The Amazing Race and Big Brother. One constant since season one, 25 years ago, is Jeff Probst, the genial, patient host, the show's guiding force, and basically the face of Survivor. To commemorate this milestone in the show's history, Probst has put together a visually fascinating tribute in book form of 50 seasons of outwitting, outlasting, and outplaying, and it's called Survivor Forged in Fire. This very good coffee table book, it's a visually striking look into the features that has made Survivor such a big hit show. There are the contestants and, you know, the wide variety of people who've actually... Now, I heard Lisa Welchel. Blair Warner from The Facts of Life was once a contestant on Survivor. The challenges, including the endurance challenge on Survivor Palau that lasted 12 hours. They were holding onto a huge bamboo pole floating in the water for 12 hours. The rewards, both immunity and food and reward challenges. The unforgivable environment. There was one time there was a typhoon and they had to evacuate the entire cast for a day or two. The tree mail, tribal council, and of course, the moment of victory for the sole survivor. Now, some of the most revealing photos in the book are the ones that are behind the camera nature, which offers the impressive scope of this production. One of them that's really striking is usually when the contestants make their first encounter with Jeff Probst, it's usually on the beach of the place where the game is going to be taking place. This is on the first day. This time, you not only see Jeff and the contestants, but you see the whole crew, the medical teams, and the behind-the-scenes personnel that almost outnumber the contestants themselves. Thoughts. So it's quite an interesting story of contrast there. But fans of the show will love this book and will further their fascination with the show that put real people in difficult situations in unfamiliar territories in order to win $1 million for their sacrificial efforts.
Have you watched the show at all, or are you a fan of the show?
Yes, I've watched the first 15 seasons, and then I came back for seasons 49 and 50. So yes, I was a regular viewer, and I came back to be a regular viewer.
I watched the first 3 series.
Yeah.
I truly believe that this show is the decline of humanity as we know it.
Well, I mean, look, that's why we like to banter about this, Peter. We have differing opinions. I mean, look, I gave myself a rest for about several years because I realized it was getting too routine. And then when a friend of mine said that it's been totally different of, you know, since season 45, that's when I decided to give it another look.
Yeah, I'm not going there. I've mentioned on several occasions, I've even interviewed several of the contestants. I love The Amazing Race. And I also believe that it has earned every single Emmy that it has won over the years.
Yeah.
Because bottom line, while there are arguments and disputes throughout the course of The Amazing Race, I just find that with the exception of maybe one or two contestants over all of the years of Amazing Race, when they get to be eliminated on The Amazing Race,
yeah,
they are still grateful for the experience that they had. I just find that Survivor just brings out the worst in people.
Well, yeah, it does do that. I mean, even after when a season is concluded, you know, there are some contestants who are grateful for the experience because this is stuff that they wouldn't do normally. But there are those who carry a grudge and sometimes carry it too far. Yeah, I do agree with you with that, Peter. And with The Amazing Race, why they're so grateful is because they explore different countries around the world that they wouldn't normally do.
And to be honest, some of the episodes or some of the seasons that while I love The Amazing Race have been a little less for me is the seasons that involve people who have been on Big Brother.
And also there are some Survivor contestants who've done The Amazing Race also.
Exactly, exactly. And these people, I just find, be it Big Brother or Survivor, are truly despicable.
Yeah, I, you know, it's amazing what, you know, how can I say, sometimes, you know, when there's such a huge bounty up for grabs, yeah, sometimes you can get a little too cutthroat, actually. And there are some who, that I'll tell you this, who I think were going to win, but get voted off because they're too good. The ones who you think, oh, well, they're going to be kicked out, they're going to be booted out, they end up being the champion. They end up winning the $1 million prize. So at least it's not predictable. There are surprises. But yeah, I mean, that's the world of unscripted TV for you.
Anyway, what is this week's book? Again, a book that I will never see. Go ahead.
Well, it's called The Survivor Forged by Fire by Jeff Probst. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $56.
And what other books do you consider in this genre that you would like to mention?
Well, I'm going to go with the premier type of reality television before the competitive unscripted type, you know, game shows, because, you know, involve real people, not celebrities, average viewers. I want to mention one book about Jeopardy is The Definitive History called Answers in the Form of Questions by Claire McNear. I've read my share of Jeopardy books, and this one is head and shoulders above the ones that were put out beforehand. And also Chuck Barris, not Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. That's sort of like a way out memoir. But he afterwards, about 10, 12 years later, Barris put out a bona fide memoir about his career as a game show producer called The Game Show King. A lot of fascinating insights on how he put together the newlywed game and the dating game and some of the not so memorable, the Gong Show, and some of the not so memorable, like the $1.98 beauty contest.
And again, this week's book, although I will never see it, is again,
It's called Survivor Forged by Fire by Jeff Probst, published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $56.
And how can we find you, sir?
Well, you won't find me in the remote islands of Fiji. You'll find me in the pages of the Montreal Times, mtltimes.ca, or on my blog, stuartnomansgrapevine.wordpress.com.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And now you could snuff out my torch for you.
Oh, I've done that a long time ago. Stuart Noman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. But, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
In a twist of poetic justice, 29-year-old Jalen Goddard from Odenton, Maryland, managed to have his own car stolen while he was busy allegedly burglarizing a business right across the street. Police were responding to a stolen vehicle report the morning of June 25th when a burglary was reported just minutes later at a Verizon store across the street. Officers began to connect the dots after noticing blood on the store's window, as well as blood on the glasses of the man who reported his vehicle was stolen. When asked to show his hands, officers discovered blood on his hand and shirt and placed him in handcuffs. The man repeatedly denied being at the Verizon store, while surveillance footage allegedly shows him burglarizing it. Said one officer, "That's some karma right there, dude," before placing the suspect in the back of a police vehicle. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're in the process of an alleged burglary, would you then call the cops to report your own car stolen? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0882. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0882. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZZHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg, Manitoba,
CFMU Hamilton, Ontario,
CKLU Sudbury, Ontario,
Local 107.3 FM St. John, New Brunswick,
CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
Sir Dudley here. You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Though Peter has had an extensive career in television, he is most suited for radio. To quote William Shakespeare, "The tartness of his face sours ripe grapes."